Welcome everybody. Yeah, part 13. No,
13, yes.
Part 13 of the Bar Mitzvah lecture for Shaul Lieberman. Always interesting stuff and more and beyond about the American history of the middle 20th century. Bakasha, Dr. Shapiro.
Okay, yes, and we're getting, I see the end though. The date is November 15th.
November 22nd. Come on,
yes.
This is an important date in world history.
18th of Kislev. I'm going to shut down all these phones that I hear people in the background. Okay, 18th of Kislev.
The 19th of Kislev, actually, by now. Okay,
we're now it's the 19th. Exactly.
Another important day in history.
I'll tell you later when I finish with this little introduction, what Lieberman said about Thanksgiving. I'll get to that in a second, but I just want to go through a few things with you. Let's see, what can I tell you about? Well, first, we lost another great person this week, Rav Shlomo Fisher. I've written about him before. He was the Rosh Hashiva Vitri, one of the most unusual Talmid Chachamim, Gaonim, people in the know will tell you that he knew more than anyone today, of anyone, and he knew it all. One of these unusual people, Shas, Poskim, philosophy, he didn't know poetry as far as I know, but all sorts of stuff. If you want to, he actually was helpful to me. I never met him. I always said when I go to Eretz Yisrael, I'll meet him, but it never happened. There's things I wanted to discuss with him, but I never did. But I know three people who are close to him. And during my conflict with Art Scroll over the censoring of the Rashbam, one of the people I know in Israel got Rabbi Fisher on the record condemning Art Scroll's censorship of the Rashbam. But you can read his book. He has halacha and other things, but his drushos beis Yishai, which are not drushos like you think of. The stuff in here, it's just, what can I say? It's on a different level. And the Torah Sheba'al Peh that we know from him is also very unusual. In fact, in Rabbi Elephant, who appointed him Rosh Yeshiva of Itri, in his unpublished memoir, which I'm going to write about this memoir. This is like the craziest memoir. And the question is, why would a Rosh Yeshiva talk about these things? And anyone who reads it, as Rabbi Rakefet said, you come up thinking half gone, half gangster. Why would any Talmud Chacham Rosh Yeshiva want to reveal about himself? So I have a whole theory about it, and I'll write about it. But and if anyone wants the memoir, well, I'm actually not going to send it out entirely. What's going around is missing a page. But he has stuff, which I'm going to supply in my post. But he has stuff about Lieberman also. But listen to what he says about Rav Shlomo Fisher. Rav Shlomo Fisher is a member of my faculty and one of the most brilliant Talmudists of the generation. He was born and raised in the heart of Mea Shearim, but he has connections with religious Zionist institutions. By the way, it's not just religious Zionist institutions. His daughter is Chana Kahat, who's like the leader of Orthodox feminism in Israel. I once came to Rav Shach and he started calling Rav Shlomo a Kalyeker, like someone not firmly devoted to the purest Torah ideals. I was annoyed, but I didn't say anything. This happened a second time. I said to myself, if this happens again, I have to do something about it. It happened again. So I went to Rav Shlomo's room here in the yeshiva. Rav Shlomo Fisher would live at the yeshiva. He only went home on Shabbos. It's like someone from like Rabbi Akiva's time. He actually lived in the yeshiva and he learned Yomam V'Laila and he only went home on weekends, even though he lived in Jerusalem. So I went to Rav Shlomo's room here in the yeshiva and I took out a letter written by the sleiper, which he calls Rav Shlomo Per Hador, the glory of the generation. Next time I went to Rav Shach, he again said that Rav Shlomo is a Kalyeker. I said, Rav Shach, listen to me. The sleiper is also a Kalyeker. He looked at me like I was crazy. But then I showed him the letter. I never heard any more complaints about Rav Shlomo. I told this to Rav Shlomo, and it didn't mean a thing to him. The only thing he cares about is understanding the Torah. Then there was a time that a member of my own staff at Itri came to me with similar objections. He wanted me to get rid of Rav Shlomo. He quotes Bialik, Nietzsche, and all sorts of things that are generally unacceptable in yeshivos. I told him, you're right, but I've got one problem. You and me, we can teach the boys here how to understand Gemara. But there's more to education than that. Who's going to teach these kids about purity, humility, and integrity? You, me? That's what we need Rosh Shlomo for. So fascinating individual, and maybe at a future class I'll show you some of the things he says that'll blow you away. And he reminds me a lot of the rabbi I told you about, Rav Yaakov Kapel Schwartz, that we the Satmar Chassid with all the unusual ideas. Rav Fisher also published this volume, his edition of Rav Chastai Kreskas's Or Hashem, with the Nekudot. This book has recently appeared. The Rabbi Buchenwald, The Life and Times of Herschel Schachter. It's like, this is like one of those books that I'm more interested, not so much in the life story of the individual, but what it tells us about American Orthodoxy in the mid-20th century. Incidentally, one of our listeners, Rabbi Barry Hartman, is quoted on page 379. But remember I said to you that my sense is that most of these traditional synagogues ended up going Orthodox, but I said I'm not sure because it's just based anecdotally, and we would need to do an actual study to see. And actually, from reading this book, I have evidence of synagogues that went conservative. Like, for example, on 378 and 379, he speaks about Beth Israel in Ottawa, Canada. That was an OU shul, non-machitza, actually low machitza, 22 inches. But when the Rabbi Finkelstein, who Rabbi Schachter sent there, when he left, they adopted mixed seating and then joined the conservative movement. On page... This book is, by the way, also relevant about the women's rabbi issue, which I think we'll get to next class. On page 478, he gives another example of Rabbi, I think his name is Siner or Siner, Alan, C-I-N-E-R, Agudas Achim, which was a mixed-seating OU synagogue in Columbus, Ohio. And after Rabbi Siner or Siner died, retired, the Machitza Minyan, they also had a Machitza Minyan, in addition to mixed seating, was disbanded, and it joined the United Synagogue, became conservative. So, again, I just repeat what I said, that anecdotes don't really solve this. We have to examine and see really which direction it went, if more of these synagogues did go the Orthodox route or not. We're going to be talking about Lieberman and Hellenism in Jewish Palestine in the next class, I think it is. And he has a whole section there about Agadah, the hermeneutic rules. And one of the things hopefully we'll get into is, what are these hermeneutic rules? Is this exegesis? Are they actually deriving it? Or can we call it another word I'll teach you here, eisegesis, which is interpretation of the text by reading into it your own ideas. So you come up with this drasha, but is it really, are they deriving it from that, or are they sticking it in? Basically, they already have this idea and they want to find a peg to put it in. I saw something very interesting, relevant, so I'll mention it to you, in Rabbi Mazuz's parsha sheet last week. I wonder if what I'm going to tell you now in the Haredi world, if this is considered like outside the fold. The interesting thing is I get to interact with so many people through these classes. I can say, from the Haredi standpoint, and they are correct, many things that are they take for granted and are obvious in the modern Orthodox world, people don't know about these things. It's just because they don't devote as much time to Talmud, I guess, Talmud study. On the other hand, things that in the modern Orthodox world they take for granted, in the Haredi world they never heard of or they wouldn't accept it. What I'm going to read you now, I have a feeling, but correct me if I'm wrong, well, people in that world. But I have a feeling that this would be regarded as just another one of Rabbi Mazuz's statements that they won't like. But it relates to what we'll see next week when we deal with Lieberman and how he understands Agadah, hermeneutic rules. This is on page, this is number 284, Tezayin Kislev, Tufshin Pei Beis, note 19. He's discussing, he gets off on all these tangents. So he discusses how both the Rosh and Tosfos learn a halacha from Haman. Haman the Rosh. What's the halacha? Well, if you look in Tosfos and Avodah Zarah, page 33b, he discusses the question of whether whether cold things absorb or not. And they bring a proof from Haman. Remember, Haman says to Ahasuerus that if a fly flies into their wine, they take out the fly and they'll drink the wine. But if you touch the wine, they can't drink it. So Tosfos and the Rosh, that's the proof that if it's not hot, it's cold, it doesn't absorb. So Rabbi Mazuz has the question, how can you, Echita King Ramon Mahaman? How can that, well, we're running halacha from Haman? And he says as follows, that we're not learning from him. Lo lomdi mimenu, rak lomdi mimasha chachamim samu b'fiv shal Haman. We're learning what the sages put in the mouth of Haman. In other words, the whole story here, which I think, at least us in the modern Orthodox world, we always assume this, but I think in the Haredi world, they view these midrashim as actual history. Haman never said this. He never actually said that there's that a fly flies into Achashverosh. But the sages, in their creating these stories, they put this in the mouth of Haman to teach us something about Haman, to give us the lesson. And since it's the sages who created this story, therefore we can derive the halacha from it. Because it's not Haman who said it, it's the sages. Now, obviously, they were trying to give an important lesson about anti-Semitism, all that. But so I found that interesting. Two more things. I want to play you something. I got a lot of comments and people text emailing me about Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman. So I started, because people asked me questions, I started looking around, finding some stuff. So let me play you 2 minutes what Rabbi Beryl Wine. Beryl Wine is from Chicago. So I thought Beryl Wine maybe was a Talmud from him. He's actually not. He's from before. He's from a Talmud of Kreisworth. I learned that from this book. This is the memoir of Beryl Wine, Rabbi Beryl Wine. But while I'm looking through it, let me show you a picture that he has in the book. Those who've been with us a while, you'll appreciate this. Here's the picture from the class before his year. He's 55 at Skokie. Actually, it was Chicago then. It becomes Skokie later. But this is the year before. You have a picture of Roy Kreisworth. But I think you'll find it interesting because we spoke a lot about wearing gowns and two of the rabbis in the front row wearing gowns. But look at the musmachim. They're all in tuxedos. Obviously not a hat among them. But even look at Rabbi Kreisworth. Today, and look at Rabbi Regensburg. Here's Rabbi Regensburg. He has a hat, that's Rabbi Rogov, but here's Rabbi Kreisworth. Also, you couldn't imagine today, you go to the YU Smicha, all the Rebbeim are wearing their hats. The idea, and look at the suit, Rabbi Kreisworth, who's a gonsa begonim, the light color suit, but today they would not dream of coming without the hat. But I want to play you what I found online from Rabbi Beryl Wine. Let me get the sound going. I think we spoke about how he's eccentric, and listen to Rabbi Wine has to say, because he knew the stories. He grew up in Chicago, and you'd always go back there. Here he is. Listen to Rabbi Beryl Wine. Let me make the sound high.
In the Chumash, Moshe will say, "Kamtem tachas avoseichem." Now you have come. As the heirs of your fathers, and you learned all their bad habits. Instead of learning their good habits, you learn their bad habits. That is something that happens in life so often. I noticed that by teachers. You know, sometimes you have teachers who are very charismatic and they have genius to them, but they're a little nuts, which, you know, that makes it interesting. But because they're nuts, so they do things. Yeah, they're a little different. So the guys always pick up the shtick. They that's what they imitate in them. They imitate the nuttiness, but the genius and the goodness and the creativity and that's like nothing. That makes no impression upon them. But the shtick, all the weird things that remain. I remember we had a teacher, a rabbi in Chicago, a great, great genius. Still alive, he still is a great, great genius, but he's very different, to put it mildly. Very different. So he used to drink tea with sugar and play chess and say the shiur at the same time. You know, somebody, like, he needed all of these props, all of these foils. So there'd be a guy playing a chess game with him, and he'd be drinking tea with the sugar, which was a whole a cube sugar. It was a whole thing, you know, fascinating thing, how you get the tea through the...
Okay, so chess, tea, and giving the shiur. And finally, someone asked me, I mentioned about the vote on the Beis Din, National Beis Din, that Rabbi Soloveitchik was not a voting member of the Halacha Commission. Now, he was on the Halacha Commission. He was the president of it. And I went back to, someone asked me about that. So I went back to Louis Bernstein's book. It's maybe not correct that he wasn't a voting member. He didn't vote in this case, but I don't know if in general he wasn't a voting member or just in this case he decided not to vote. So that's a good clarification. Well, I'll talk maybe again another time about Rabbi Bernstein's book. I find it because it's here's the book, Challenge and Mission. The Emergence of the English-Speaking Orthodox Rabbinate. The advantage of this book is that apparently all the archival stuff he used in the RCA has disappeared or was lost. So the only record we have of it is in this book. Let us pick up now where we left off. We've got lots of stuff here. Even before we do that, I should tell you about Lieberman and Thanksgiving. We're going to hit a lot of great stuff today, including, I hope, finally give you the answer for the great dispute between the Rav and Lieberman, we spoke about a few semesters ago. But what do I want to begin with? Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving's coming up. Those of us Americans, we know Thanksgiving. I always say, and it's actually a true story because I did it once. I told a Haredi guy once that on Thanksgiving in Israel, the Agudas Yisrael always has a convention. They read the Torah on Thanksgiving. And the guy didn't believe me. I said, I guarantee you they read the Torah every Thanksgiving. And he thought I was joking with them. But I'm not joking. And if you're not an American, I don't think you might not know what I'm talking about. But for those who aren't American who are going to be watching us on YouTube, Thanksgiving always comes out on Thursday. So it's never Nidcha. It's always Thursday. Although they won't have turkey at the Agudas Yisrael convention, at least not anymore, they will definitely read the Torah. But Lieberman held, and this is reported in many places, you just Google it. I just Googled it and find a number of people speaking about it. He held that you should not recite, Americans living in America should not recite Tachanun on Thanksgiving. He thought that he said that as Americans, we share the joy of the rest of our nation this day, and we should leave this out. So that was Lieberman's position. I tried to find if anyone else ever had that. I figured maybe if anyone would be Spanish and Portuguese. I spoke to Rabbi Angel years ago, and he said, no, they do say Tachanun. But what I did find, and I thank Alan Brill, he had a post on this a while back, is that... They still do this, or at least they did it as of 10 years ago or 15 years ago in Asher Bay Angel. But here you have from 1945, there was a whole synagogue service, special synagogue service for Thanksgiving Day that you recite after davening. But not just there, as Rabbi as Brill has documented, here's KJ did it as well. Here's a synagogue service from 1940. I don't know if they do it today, but 1940. You have Matovu with the choir, your procession of the colors, presentation of the American flag. Then they would read, solemnly read Franklin Roosevelt's Thanksgiving proclamation. Or is it Teddy Roosevelt? I forget now. Teddy Roosevelt, right? They have the lieutenant governor, Leno Donolam. So it was very common in America to do that sort of thing. I'll have to look it up later. I know there's a whole debate about when it was first celebrated Thanksgiving, but I'm not actually sure what maybe some of you know. No, it's Franklin. I'm sorry, it's Franklin Roosevelt. because I'm looking online now. In 1939, he signed a presidential proclamation changing the day to the next to last Thursday. And so that's the Roosevelt it's referring to. Okay. Now that you have that, ask your local rabbi about Tachanun. But you should know that Tachanun is not recited by many Hasidim. They don't recite it a lot. I found that they don't recite it on Yort sites. And many of them don't recite it a lot more than that because of at Mincha. There's a whole tradition that if you daven Mincha after Shkia, you're not supposed to do, say, Tachanun. And Hasidim routinely daven Mincha after Tachanun. By the way, you shouldn't condemn them for that. Although the Mishnah Berurah says you can't, but most Ashkenazi Jews before World War II in Europe daven mincha after Shkia. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, you can daven until it says. The Vilna Gaon was against it, and the Mishnah Berurah was against it, but the general Minhag Yisrael was to daven, in the Ashkenazic world, was to daven mincha after Shkia. And this, if you're wondering, if you're not ninth person and you're waiting, should you it's Shkia, but someone's coming to make the minyan, do you wait or not? Okay, so that's a machokas. The Mishnah Berurah says not to, but Minhag Yisrael always was. I found, incidentally, that Rabbi Sternbach in Shulas Hagos, Volume 3, number 53, goes off very angry against he says that they publicize in some shul that you don't say Tachanun at Mincha at all. And he talks about how important it is to say Tachanun, but I think the reason is because in that shul, they daven after Shkia. So why do I mention this? Because Lieberman's colleague, Heschel, held that today, or at least I shouldn't say held, he did not do Tachanun at all. He got rid of Tachanun, totally. Why? You can read about this in Edward Kaplan's book, Spiritual Radical, page 99. He says as follows, because the Hasidic custom is on the Yort side of a Rebbe, you don't say Tachanun because it's not a day of sorrow, but of renewal and celebration. But he says after the Holocaust, virtually every day is a day where a tzaddik was killed. And therefore, Heschel felt that by being silent, he memorialized a different tzaddik every day. If you want to learn more about Heschel, someone asked me to do about Heschel. I'm not going to do it. The only thing we'll talk about Heschel is maybe next class or then the class after, Lieberman's relationship with him. Not such a good one, let's put it that way, yeah. But in this book by Samuel Dresner, Heschel, Hasidism, and Halacha, there's a whole chapter here on Halacha. And if you're wondering, Lieberman, he went to teach it with the conservative. Heschel went to Hebrew Union College before he went to JTS. That's where he were. And in this book, he quotes on page 92, Heschel telling the Hebrew Union College the Convention of Reform Rabbis, students of Hebrew Union College, that there is no Agadah without Halacha. There can be no Jewish holiness, no Jewish law. Why are you afraid of wearing tallis and tefillin every morning, my friends? He says, our task is to adjust Western civilization to Judaism. America needs Shabbos. What's wrong with Shabbos? What's wrong with saying a bracha every time we eat? What's wrong with spiritual discipline? So here you have Heschel speaking to the Reform rabbis, telling them, you too need halacha. Doesn't sound like people's image of Heschel, but Heschel was, as with Lieberman, a complete Shomer Torah mitzvos, but very different. We ended last class. We were talking all about, it took us a number of weeks, the whole dispute between Lieberman and the Orthodox. I think I set it out in a clear and understand manner, this great machokas in the Orthodox world. There's just two more things I want to say about this, because very similar to what happened with Lieberman, happened with someone else at the seminary. We know, as I spoke about, the seminary is full of Orthodox teachers. That's the whole seminary was Orthodox teachers there. But for the most part, in their communities, it didn't really have an effect. They still went to their shul, did their thing. But Lieberman, because of his standing, that created a controversy. After all, he was coming. He was like one of the regarded as like a minor Gadol B'Yisrael already in Jerusalem, and everyone had high hopes that he was going to be one of the great Gadolim of the generation. That was a different situation. But there was another case, and by a community that's very close, and you don't really break with their norms. And it's with this individual. Rabbi Jose Faur. Jose Faur, we've heard Rabbi Shugna was a student, many others as a student. I can't say that I was a student of his, but I knew him, and he helped me when I was writing my piece on Lieberman. He passed away just last year, June of 2020. He is a chacham. I have read all of his stuff on halacha and commentaries and Jewish stuff, but not the stuff. He became an expert in all this in people like Derrida and Levinas. That stuff I don't really understand. But a real chacham, and he comes from Argentina, comes to America. He goes to Lakewood. He becomes such a close student to Rav Aaron Cutler that at the funeral, he was one of the people who carried the coffin. I heard that story, and I didn't know if it was true when I asked him, and it is indeed true. He opened a yeshiva in Brooklyn in 1956, and Rav Aaron came and spoke at it. But then he moved away. He fell out in that world. He wrote about what he liked about Lakewood and what he couldn't deal with. He goes off to Spain and gets a PhD, comes back, and he teaches at the seminary. He teaches at the seminary with the approval of his Rebbe, Rav Matrub Abadi. I published in Soliman the Orthodox one letter from Rav Matrub Abadi in support. Subsequently, on the Sorenbog, I published another letter, and I have a third letter, Rav Matrub Abadi, who he brought one day to speak to Lieberman. Matrub Abadi was a businessman, but he was one of the two great chachamim of the Syrian community. The other was Rabbi Jacob Kassin. And Rabbi Jacob Kassin also publicly supported Faur's teaching at the seminary. After Faur said to him, I'm just doing it to teach Torah. I don't share the philosophy of it. But although the Syrian community prides itself on being independent and doing it their own path, they are influenced by outsiders. And Rav Moshe and then later Rav Shach and Rav Vad Yosef, they weighed in on this. Why they weigh on this? Because people in the Syrian community who had gone to places like Lakewood, they start going to yeshivas. The first ones they went to, incidentally, were many of them was near Yisrael. But they start already in the 50s, they start going to the Haredi yeshivas, and by the 70s, it's already, they have many of them. They went to the Ashkenazi Gedolim, and they went to Rav Yosef and said, how can we have someone in our community teaching in the Syrian community? He was giving classes, Torah classes, in the Syrian community at the same time that he's at JTS. And it became a lot of pressure was brought. Rabbi Kassin withdrew his support. And this split the Syrian community in that among the more liberal ones, Faur had his followers and he always had his followers. And you can read about it in Sol Lieberman the Orthodox. But for the most of the Syrians just follow whatever the rabbis say. They're not independent thinkers in this respect. And they themselves maybe are not so stringent. But if the Chacham says it, they follow. So really, Rabbi Faur was, because of his association with the seminary, which ended when they started ordaining women, but he was pretty much pushed out of any Torah leadership role in the Syrian community. So it's in miniature exactly what happened with Rav Shaul Lieberman. The final comment I just want to make, and then briefly, is after my Sol Lieberman the Orthodox appeared, Professor David Galinkin wrote a whole response, published first on the Sforim blog and later in Conservative Judaism. Was Professor Sol Lieberman Orthodox or conservative? And he takes me on, and I do not accept at all the guys. I said that he distorted David Galinkin, who's like a leading halachist today in the conservative movement. He published the Louis Ginsberg Shivut. He's written many volumes of responsa. I said he distorted Lieberman's legacy by referring to him as a conservative rabbi, and I stand by that. Lieberman wasn't a conservative rabbi any stretch, but he says. So he doesn't defend that. In fact, he says in his piece that he wasn't conservative, but he says that I'm wrong to refer to Lieberman as Orthodox, and I'm wrong to refer to the seminary as conservative. Now, why does he say this? He says during the years that Lieberman taught at the seminary, almost all the faculty were observant Jews, which I've acknowledged. We said it's the old joke. The seminary was Orthodox teachers teaching conservative rabbis to minister to Reform laity. So that's, he has like 9 points. So I accept that. His next point is that, which he says that I stress it myself, is that in the 40s and 50s, most of the students at JTS were completely observant and many came from Orthodox homes. Yes, I said that as well. And then he says in the point three that the division between Orthodox and conservative was not at all clear. Indeed, that was pointed out by Shapiro himself, as he writes. Okay, so it doesn't say anything. He points out that the seminary had separate seating for men and women. So it's not really a conservative institution, but again, he had separate seating in a machitza. He points out that the seminary never used the rabbinical assembly sidur. Okay. He points out that the seminary did not teach higher criticism at that time of the Pentateuch. He points out, this is seven, this is a strange one, that when Lieberman started teaching at the seminary, rabbinical students dressed just like rabbinical students at Yeshiva University. I don't know why that's important. He mentions that, and this is important, that Finkelstein, as well as Ginsberg, saw the seminary as an institution for Kol Yisrael, not just for the conservative movement. That is true. And I mentioned that as well. He says that I quote a letter from Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg that the seminary wanted to invite him. And Weinberg didn't say he couldn't teach there because it was conservative. He said they don't need him. But that's not actually what Weinberg said. Weinberg simply said he wonders why they would invite him when they have Lieberman and Ginsberg. His point, therefore, is that JTS wasn't a conservative institution, and Lieberman really wasn't Orthodox. He was Torah observant. So what I'll say to that briefly is that it is true that the seminary was in theory independent. I mean, it was not controlled by the rabbinical assembly and was often at odds. And they did want to have much broader reach. The fact remains that the conservative rabbis came out of the seminary. That's where you got the conservative. You didn't have to. You could have gotten somewhere else. But it was intimately tied to the rabbinical assembly, even though the Talmud faculty had independent ideas. And was tied to Camp Ramah. It was viewed by everyone as a conservative institution. And for the reasons, now what we're saying, is it the same as your local conservative synagogue? Absolutely not. But it's part and parcel of the conservative movement. I don't need to justify that. That's the whole institution is built on that, even if it's on the right wing and its teachers don't necessarily identify with it. Now, as for and Dalinkin himself later in the same essay mentions that Lieberman taught at the conservative rabbinical seminary. So it was, you can't deny that. But what he says that Lieberman never called himself Orthodox. Lieberman denied that he's conservative. He did say that. He said, I'm not a conservative Jew. But what Lieberman said, spoke about, Lieberman was a Shomer Torah Mitzvos. And what Dalinkin's saying is that for me to refer to Lieberman as Orthodox, that's wrong. I should refer to him as Shomer Torah Mitzvos because you have people who are not Orthodox who are also Shomer Torah Mitzvos. Okay, all I'll say to that is when I use the term Orthodox, when I said Orthodox, I just was using it as a shorthand as one who accepts traditional halakha in line with the Shulchan Aruch. That's what I mean by it. Simple as that. So I don't want to get tied up on semantics. So the term Orthodox itself is just an American term. If you're in Israel, you don't use the term Orthodox. You use the term Dati or Haredi or Shomer Torah Mitzvos. So Lieberman clearly saw himself as part of the community of the Shomrei Torah U'Mitzvos. And that community is the same community he came from and the same community that he regarded himself as part of. Were the Shomrei Torah Mitzvos and conservatives? Certainly. And the people he davened with at the seminary synagogue, he regarded them as part of this community of Shomrei Torah Mitzvos. But he did not regard himself as part of the community of the vast conservative synagogues around the country. There's no way you can deny that. He believed that many of them were doing wonderful things and important things, even if they were mistaken on other things. But he was, I remember I once asked Halivni this question. I said, is it possible to regard Lieberman at all as conservative? And he thought it was such a stupid question. Like, how would you even ask such a question? Leave it at that. Let me talk about some of the writings now that Lieberman wrote in the post-war years. We already spoke about his Shekiyin and his early work on the Tosefta, on Yerushalmi, but he wrote some other works now that we have to deal with in the post-war years. The first one is, and it appears in 1948, is this volume. This is a second edition, very large, actually. It's pretty large. Other than Shas, which is, it's pretty big, but the biggest book I have, let me show you the largest book I have. It's taller than any of the Shas has had. The heaviest book I ever had was given to me by someone from Toronto. It's they came on one of our trips. It's the grandchildren, the granddaughter and grandson-in-law of Rabbi Price of Toronto. He wrote these books on the commentary on Sefer Hasidim and on the Smog. They are not just big as this. They are thick and heavy, the biggest books you can imagine. So he sent me a couple of them. I don't want to ask him what the postage was, but let me show you something here. This is taller than I have a Shas, which is the old-fashioned Vilna Shas, very tall. But this book is even taller. This guy in Israel published, he's not going to write about it, on Sfarma, his own Gemara on Maseches Otzin. The Maseches Otzin is a Mishnayas. He created his own Gemara, and it's a huge volume. It's huge in terms of size. I don't know why I made it so big. I don't know where I'm going to put it, but it's a work of genius. He creates a whole Gemara, just like the Radziner created a Gemara, but he creates a Gadata too, and he's not a Haredi. In fact, on the very first page, he cites Geiger. He has a Rashi, he has Tosfos. He's very unusual, very strange. I think he's a former Ger Chassid, actually. So I'll write about this, but I think one of the people listening to us is very interested in Maseches Uktzin. So if you're interested in Uktzin, you want to get this. It's a big lesson now. But what is this Hilchos Yerushalmi? Well, the Rambam, we know the Rambam wrote a work on the Yerushalmi. And we discovered it in the Geniza. And he includes in the back here pages in the Rambam's own hand. Pretty much everyone agrees it's the Rambam's own hand. It's like a riff. It's a halachic text of the Yerushalmi. We only have a few sections of it on Brachos, Subos, it's with Lieberman's commentary. So for those in yeshivas, you should know about this. This is the Rambam. This is a work from the Rambam. We're not sure why he decided to make the Rambam. Yerushalmi is very important for the Rambam. Why he decided to make like a riff, just include the halacha stuff in the Yerushalmi. It's not clear, but you can read all about it in Lieberman's work. So very important. This is his first work that he published when he comes to America. Hilchos Yerushalmi. However, the major work that he wrote is, of course, here's volume one. Fortunately, the seminary keeps it in print, so you can pick it up if you're going to be studying Tosefta. Tosefta is not really what most people study, but Tosefta Kifshuta. A number of volumes. First, he has an edition of the Tosefta, corrected from manuscripts with a mini commentary, and then he has this major commentary. Which nothing's ever been written like this on the Tosefta or on the Mishnah, for that matter. You could do the same thing, I guess, with the Mishnah. But it's hard for me to stress how great his knowledge was, how he had his hand on everything, not just on the rabbinic texts and all the Rishonim who deal with it, but on the realia. Descriptions, the Greek, the Latin, to understand what they're referring to, all the parallel texts in Greek literature. One of his students, not an actual student, but a follower, Eliezer Shimshon Rosenthal, he says he wrote an article about Lieberman. He called her Hamola, the teacher, but he says as follows, and this is exactly Lieberman's approach. On three things, al shosha devarim, the academic study of Talmud depends. And this is what you'll see in Tosefta Kifshuta. On the nusach, is you have to determine the proper nusach, especially something like the Tosefta, this proper text. There's been all sorts of mistakes. On the language, what do the words mean? There's all sorts of words. I'm going to show you an example next class or hopefully next class, I'll give you some examples where we don't know what the words mean. Well, Lieberman can tell us what they mean because he knows the ancient languages. And al ha-context, ha-sifruti, ha-historia, reality, ke-echad. And on the literary, the historical, and the realia context. In other words, if the rabbis are writing about something, let's say they're writing about a stove. So you need to know how the stove works in ancient times. Let's say they're describing some military thing. Well, you can't figure out what they're describing and halachic or even agadic implications unless you know how, like, Roman legions worked. All these things are of vital importance. Now, they're obviously not of importance in the yeshivas. In fact, I'm going to read to you now something Rav Uchnesin wrote. Hold on. Which I'll show you. We're going to see the difference, the great difference between Rav Soloveitcher and Rav Uchnesin. But since I mentioned everything Lieberman's interested in, and it's pshat, it's not higher criticism, it's not Halivni style, he's not looking at who offered the sugya and where the Savarayim put it in, and did the Amoraim really understand the Mishnah? No, it's just explaining the pshat. Wait till you hear what Rabbi Weinberg says about it. But Rabbi Lichtenstein wrote an essay. It hasn't been translated to English. I don't know why. It should be. You can see it on the Haaretz Zion website. I just printed it out earlier today. It's called Lederech Limudo Shel Rav Soloveitchik, the Method of Study of Rav Soloveitchik. And it's a wonderful essay on the Brisker method and Rav Soloveitchik's approach and Kedarka Bakodesh, as is his way. Rav Lichtenstein is not hesitant to point out softly where he disagrees with Rabbi Soloveitchik. He says things like, well, you know, I might see it differently. That he said things like that. He wasn't, he had his own way of looking at things. I mean, famously, Rabbi Lichtenstein said about Rav Soloveitchik in a Lachic Man, where he talks about how the Chabadnik is crying. He's about to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. He starts crying. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik he says, why are you crying? Do you cry when you put tefillin on? I don't remember exactly what the other mitzvah he gave example of, but it's a mitzvah. What are you crying for? And Rav Aaron said that, in his opinion, that's a little over the top, because obviously blowing the shofar is not just like any other mitzvah. We spoke about this, if you recall, a few semesters ago, but this is what Rav Lichtenstein says. He says, I remember a number of years ago, I met Rav Shaul Lieberman, Zichron Uvracha. He told me, shocked, that he had a meeting, and he was with a Talmud Chacham of renown, who didn't know what Radias Hapas is. The Gemara speaks about this. I don't exactly know what they're referring to either. It's removing dough from an oven. So, I mean, I don't know what the ovens look like, and I don't know. I guess he'd be angry at me too, but I'm not a Talmud Chacham Bal Shir Kom, as he says. You have to look in Steinsaus. Maybe there's a picture, but there's halachas about the, you know, if you have bread stuck to the side of the oven. So I guess if you really want to understand it, you need to know what the ovens are. It reminds me of someone told me, I heard this from my Davin Miller, that he was a student at Yus Michal during the few years that Chaim Soloveitchik was Rosh Hashiv. He was Rosh Hashiv there for a few years. And he made everyone, they had to know the laws in Rashi. You know, Rashi cites it, and it's the old French, but that's, we all skip over that. But Professor Soloveitchik, then he was Rosh Hashiv, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he's going to skip over it. And sometimes you can learn a great deal because he's telling you what it means. So if you know what the French is, Rabbi Miller told us that all the students, they all had to get the dictionary. There was a French dictionary, old dictionary, which explained all these things. But he's probably the only Rosh Yeshiva in history who insists that you know what he's saying. So he says that Lieberman was shocked that this Talmud Chacham didn't know what Radias Hapas is, you know, the reality of it. And he says, Hayitakein, is this possible? This is the Talmud Chacham. He says, the Gemara in Shabbos deals a lot with this and talks about the Heter of Radias Hapas on Shabbos. And he didn't even know, this Talmud Chacham, how does he know what the halach is? Because he doesn't even know what it's talking about. He just knows Lebnus. And Rav Lichtenstein says, from Lieberman's perspective, we can understand why he's all shocked this. But from another perspective, and this is, you know, if you look at Reb Chaim's approach, you can analyze and dissect and come up with chidushim about Radias Hapas and try to explain it. What is the category? Chachma she'eni ma'malacha. What's the definition of a malacha derabanan here? And what's the connection between a shlus? Without having any clue exactly how the oven works. That's what Lichtenstein says. And you don't even have to know the shlavim of otah malacha mebichinat miyitzit taknit. He says, of course, if you're a posek and you're posking, then you need to know, Rav Lichtenstein says. But if you're just doing lomdus, you're discussing the sugya. What does it matter exactly how the oven looks? That's not your concern. So for Lieberman, this is just unheard of. And he can't accept that that's, it's not a question for him. If you're trying to understand the sugya, the first thing about the sugya is pshat. Then comes lumdis, and he could do lumdis. He hardly ever does it, but I have a letter from Lieberman to one of the Gedolim, which I'm going to publish. And they even wanted me to publish it in his journal. Hamashbir, yes, because I published something and I'm publishing new stuff in it, but I'm going to do it next issue. He has a real traditional yeshivish Torah letter. But first you need to know the pshat. And Lieberman would go further than that. The old joke of the Maskilim was that, against the Maskilim, was they can tell you the clothes Rashi wore, we can tell you, his shitot, what he believes in halacha. Professor Sperber has a whole article there in which he starts with that, the importance of reality, and that sometimes, knowing what the clothes they wore can teach us halacha as well. Now, this is for Lieberman, of course, this is secondary. The important thing is understanding what the Gemara is saying in terms of halacha, but often, if you really want to know what the Gemara is saying, you need to know the realia. This, as I said, you can't overestimate how important this is. Let me just read you what Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg wrote. I found the letter from Rabbi Weinberg to Lieberman in the Lieberman Archive. I published it in volume 1 of Kisrei Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. It's number 72. He says as follows. This is Rabbi Weinberg. With great joy, I received the three volumes of the Tosefta you sent me. And I thank you for sending me this wonderful gift. I made a bracha shachayanu. Why? Shezachinu anachnu b'nei dorenu. That we in this generation are zoche, mashalo zachu adoras akodmin. What the previous generations did not have. Namely, a scientifically exacting edition of the teachings, the Torah teaches, the Tanaim. Ashrei hador, he says. Fortunate is the generation that you, Shaul Lieberman, Sharai Basocho, Kirak Hu Levado, only you, is Huchshar Lavoda Madais Anakiso. Only you are capable of doing this with your great Bakios, Bechochedra Torah, and with all the scientific literature, and with your genius ability to explain Perush Pashut, Umeir Seinayim. Because of what you did, the Tosefta has now been brought into the Beis Medrash for study. Rabbi Weinberg writes in the introduction to his first book on Talmud, Mechrami Talmud, that people think Pshat is simple. Pshat is not simple. Pshat is very hard. It's called Pshat not because it's simple. It's called Pshat because it's the basic explanation. So look what Rabbi Weinberg, who among the Gedolei Yisrael, he understood what academic study is. There were some. He wasn't the only one. But look the way he's writing to Lieberman. He appreciates what this is. As I said, it's not modern scholarship in the sense of higher criticism. It's a pshat commentary. Simple as that. Although Lieberman, he has interesting theories, ideas. There's been a number of articles written on it. So we spoke earlier about how different texts often preserve different traditions. Lieberman argues in many places that you have, for instance, there's different manuscripts. One of the manuscripts is the Erfurt manuscript, important manuscript. One day, God willing, we'll start up again our tourist trip to Germany. You go to Erfurt. Erfurt, very interesting. They have a treasure they found there. They dug up when they were doing excavations in the Jewish quarter, all this beautiful jewelry from Jewish people. It's priceless. So that's what people go to see there. But it's also the Erfurt manuscript, because the great Tosefta manuscript was kept in Erfurt. Sometimes the version of that is different than other manuscripts. So people generally say, well, there's a copyist error, things like that. Lieberman argues in a number of places that no, each Tosefta version preserves a different shita. In some places, he says that Erfurt could preserve Yerushalmi, the other preserved Bavli. So you need to be a genius like Lieberman to be able to include everything, not just the text, but also the Oshas, Bavli, Yerushalmi at his fingertips. So it's a traditional commentary in the focus on Pshat, but obviously much broader than is found in Yeshiva. So I encourage anyone who's into learning, who hasn't yet seen it, check it out. You're not going to look at it and be like, if you're reading Reb Chaim and all of a sudden you're reading Chidushim. No, it's not that. It's for page after page to understand Pshat. He also edited at this time Rav David Pardo, an important 18th century rabbi from Italy, who wrote a commentary on the Tosefta. I saw someone who wrote, Lieberman has an introduction, and he signs the introduction, Shin Lamed. So someone wrote, Lieberman edited the Tosefta Kivshuta, I mean, so the Tosefta of Rav David Pardo, but the publishers don't want to tell you who wrote it. So therefore, they have his name as who edited it. So they have his name as abbreviation. He has his notes throughout the whole thing. It's completely wrong in every one of Lieberman's writings. Look at the beginning of the introduction here. Hold on. He always writes Shin Lamed. It's not the publisher. That's how he signed all of his introductions. I want to now tell you, we have a few minutes so we can begin, about Rabbi Soloveitchik and Lieberman. Well, first, in this sefer, Igros Malche Rabbanan, some of you are with us 53 classes. So if you go back to page 341, number 158, there's a Rav Herschel Schechter writes to me after receiving Saul Lieberman the Orthodox, and he says, the 10 years that I was in Rav Soloveitchik Shiurim, I recall him only one time mentioning Lieberman, and that has to do with the idea of a Kohen is not forbidden to be metame, come impure by touching a sheretz, a creepy crawly thing, or an animal, you can also say, because it's the same thing. And Rav Schechter brings this in Nefesh HaRav. What does Rav Schechter cite in Nefesh HaRav, page 248? Rav Schechter says as follows. He says, Rabbeinu, that's Rabbi Soloveitchik, told that once he met Rabbi Shaul Lieberman, Rav Schechter calls him Rabbi Shaul Lieberman, gives him all the respect, at a Sudas Bris Mila. And Lieberman said to him that in the Tshuvas Gaonim, he found that Kohanim are forbidden from coming into contact with a Nevela, a dead animal. And Rabbi Soloveitchik replied to him, you don't need to be concerned about this at all, because it's against the halacha, and that his grandfather, Reb Chaim, he knew how to learn better than many of the Gaonim, because we're not talking about one of the important Gaonim like Rav Haibom. So as I said, if you recall, when we first did this, the story here is messed up a little, because it has nothing to do with the Gaonim. I'm going to read you the actual word for word of what Rav Soloveitchik said later, unless he misspoke in Rav Schechter's class, but I think Rav Schechter probably is misremembering. He's not referring to the Gaonim. But it's good that that's the way Rav Schechter. Or maybe, you know what, because I take that back. Rav Soloveitchik, I guess, in Shir, we have a tape of him, and we see where I guess he's more careful in what he said. But in Shir, he must have said the Gaonim, because that led him to say that my grandfather knew how to learn better than a lot of the Gaonim. So, but it wasn't the Tshuva of the Gaonim. That's not what Lieberman told him. And there is no Tshuva of the Gaonim who said that. In fact, if there was a Gaon who said it, then the Rav would be correct that he is an Amaretz, because the Gaonim are bound by Talmudic halacha. And anyone in the Gaonic period who's bound by Talmudic halacha who says that Kohanim can't come into contact with Nevela, he is an Amaretz. He's not a Gaon. He's just someone who lived in the Gaonic period who wrote something down. And just as Rav Soloveitchik's point was, just because something was preserved for all this time, written during, you know, doesn't make you a Gaon, just because you were a writer then. But that's not what the Rav, I mean, he might have said it in Shir there, but it's not accurate. What is accurate is what he gave a talk. We have him at the RCA convention. This is in the Rav, Rabbi Rakefet's work, volume 2, page 27, which is just a translated talks. There's many, many talks of Rav Soloveitchik. If you go to YU Torah, you see many talks of Rav Soloveitchik in Yiddish. So if you know Yiddish, you can listen to those. I'll have to keep you busy. Also in English, they have stuff, and there's these new people, these new videos that have been coming out. Well, not videos. They have the Rav, but many of the Rav's important materials being put out in Yiddish, but also with English subtitles. So this took place in 1974 at the RCA annual convention. So let me read it to you, and then we'll have to maybe for next class get back to Shama Friedman is going to reveal what the Rav is actually referring to. Rav Lieberman. He says as follows. The Rav begins by saying that a Kohen can defile himself by contact with a sheretz, that's a creeping animal, or a zav, and it's just a person you can't be metame to. And then he says, listen to this. I remind myself, I had an encounter quite a number of years ago with a representative of the so-called Chochmas Yisrael, Wissenschaft des Judentums. He was a very outstanding scholar. And the note points out correctly that's referring to Lieberman. Although the Rav is not correct here, I think, in calling him a representative of Chochmas Yisrael. Yes, he was involved in the Chochmas Yisrael, but he's not a representative like Yaakov Nachum Epstein or something. He's a traditional Talmud Chacham who also has his hand in Chochmas Yisrael. But usually we think of Chochmas Yisrael, we think of people who that's their primary task is academic study. No, the academic, we'll see next class, the Hellenism and Jewish Palestine, all these articles, these are minor things for Lieberman. Lieberman's major thing was the study of Torah. And the study of Torah is the traditional study of Torah, bringing in all the sources. I also would say to Rabbi Rakefet, the translation of Chochmas Yisrael as Wissenschaft des Judentums is incorrect. Chochmas Yisrael refers, Wissenschaft des Judentums refers to like German academic scholars. And people writing in German, but Chochmas Yisrael, that encompasses traditional Talmid HaChachamim also. It encompasses people like Albeck and others who are writing, who are editing from manuscript, halachic works using scientific method, but we don't call them really Wissenschaft, because everything they're doing is in Lashon HaKodesh. Okay, so he goes on. He was a very outstanding scholar. He told me that lately they had discovered a parchment, a Megillah, in which it was stated unequivocally that a Kohen is enjoined from defiling himself with a Sheretz. So notice, the Rav here isn't saying Goni. He's saying a parchment, a Megillah. That already should give it away. What is the Megillah? I'm not dealing with some Geniza text. The Megillah, what do we call the Dead Sea Scrolls? They call them the Megillot. That's what Lieberman is referring to. I'll give you the exact source. Probably next class. So I said to him, do you take it seriously? That is this position. Of course, he answered, very seriously. You know, they, meaning the academic scholars, have the answer right away. It's a different Kabbalah, a different tradition. They operate with traditions in the plural. So I mentioned a name to him. This name was known to him, and I knew that he did not like the person. I asked him, do you know him? Yes, he answered. Is he a scholar? I asked. No, he is a boor, and I'm Aretz Midaraisa, he answered. I said to him, so only we have a monopoly on boor, and I'm Aretz Midaraisa? 1,500 years ago, there were also boors, and I'm Aretz. Since there was no paper, the boor had to write on parchment. So you found nice Chidushi Torah. So what? This is a true story. Well, as we'll see next class, it's not Chidushi Torah. And I think we'll agree that Lieberman is correct. There are traditions. The whole Dead Sea sect is a tradition. It's not our tradition, but it is a tradition. As for the question that you don't ask me because I don't have an answer, what about Lashon Hara? The Rav says to him, so here you have this scholar. What do you think about him? So Lieberman says, well, I don't like him. And he's not Amaretz. So the Rav agrees, yes, he's not Amaretz, but you think he's the only Amaretz? They are Amaretz seen 1,500 years ago. All I can tell you is that traditional Lithuanian Talmudists, when they thought someone was not Amaretz, they were not shy about saying so. And maybe they didn't think it's Lashon Hara because they figure if you're going to come into the Milchamta Shel Torah, if you're going to come battle in the yeshivas, and the academic world, and you're going to battle in Torah, that if you come into the ring, then you're allowing yourself fair game, that you publish something, you say something, we're going to say that you don't know what you're talking about. You're not Amaretz. And at the end of the day, is it any different about saying that someone wrote Amaretzus, everything he writes is Amaretzus, versus saying he's an Amaretz? If all he does is write Amaretzus, then he's an Amaretz, I guess. It's the same thing. So in the Litvisha world, you needed thick skin. Even in Shir, be it Rav Aaron Cutler, the Rav, if you said a Svara that Rav Aaron, he's quoted in Making the Gadol, calling someone a Paraduma, this redhead, and the Rav, before he mellowed, you didn't want to say a bad Svara, and Lieberman also. So that's their world. I like to think that maybe there's an automatic assumption, just like when you drive on the highway, you're taking on the risks. That you could be in an accident. When you step into the Lithuanian Torah world, you're mochel. That if you say something stupid, they're going to call you out and tell you it's stupid. You know when you knew the Rav had mellowed. The famous story that Chaim Soloveitchik, he was in Israel for a few years in the 60s. He comes back to YU in the late 60s in a Rosh Hashiva, and he sits in on the Rav Shir, and someone says something in class, and the Rav says, replies like, that is interesting. And later Chaim is supposedly said to Rav Schechter, who was also there, that he doesn't know what happened. You know, 10 years ago, someone would have said that, the Rav would have thrown him out. And now he's mellowed, and he says it's interesting. But that's the Lithuanian Torah world. What we're going to do next class, I'll begin. So what is this Megillah? Well, Shama Friedman is going to tell us. It actually comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Wait till I review it. And then I want to speak about, if you think that this point I made about Lieberman being a traditional Torah scholar who incorporates Chachos Yisrael, but he's a traditional Torah scholar, unlike others. And I'll speak about one man in particular, Solomon Zeitlin. And wait till you hear how Lieberman goes off against Solomon Zeitlin. And it's important to see where Lieberman's coming from, because he's really coming from a place of Torah. And just when I read you what he says, it's like about how just the respect he has for Gedolei Yisrael. This isn't what you see in Wissenschaft, and it isn't even what you see in many of the Chochmas Yisrael. And maybe next class we'll get to also what happens, the changes in the seminary in the 70s that will lead us to really the great break and the women's ordination issue, because that's where Lieberman, after really being away from the public eye for decades, just focused on scholarship. In the 50s, he was involved with the Ketubah and the National Beis Din. And then for the next 20 years, you know, he's the Orthodox world doesn't regard him anymore as part of theirs, but he's only involved in Torah study. But then he once again emerges because of the issues in the conservative movement, and his students turn to Lieberman. And of course, we'll see the great irony. I'll talk about some of the issues. We'll have to speak about the halachic matter of what's wrong with a woman being a rabbi halachically. Is there something wrong? Is this only about Masorah? We'll analyze Lieberman's tshuva. We'll see what Herschel Schechter does with it, and look at some of the other Gedolim, what they had to say about this as well. So let me take the questions and the comments now. Thank you all again for coming out. Let's see, what do we have here? Someone asked me about Beth Israel in Montreal. Which year? I don't know about that show when it leaves. I assume he means leaves Orthodox and goes to the Conservative. I don't know.
If you're in Ottawa, if it's I don't know, Rabbi Finkelstein Shul,
yeah, Rabbi Finkelstein.
Probably about 12, 15 years ago. Okay, I don't remember exactly. Yeah, I remember reading about it in the Canadian Jewish News, a little article about it, and the membership voted, you know, times are different, and time to move to the conservative movement.
Okay, Rabbi Zak discusses at great length in his wonderful book on Torah, what you mean, the idea of inserting ideas?
Yeah, whether the psukim mean what that's what they really mean, or Chazal made it up and they looked at, not made okay. it up, whatever, and they went back to the psukim.
I was speaking about agadic things. Of course, halachic things, then it's more controversial, because then you have the great dispute between the Rambam and the Ritva. The Rambam thought that a lot of these drashot are just asmachta, but the halacha is independent, and that's what we spoke about this when we dealt with my book. The Ritva calls this dat minut, a heretical idea, because if you look in the Gemara, it sure looks like it's exegesis, not eisegesis. They're actually derived. The Rav himself, once he was asked about this, once he said Chazal kadarshan. I mean, if you look at it, it does look like Chazal are actually deriving halacha. But with agadic statements, doesn't raise any theological questions. I'm not sure what Professor Besser means by not really sages, Targum Sheni. And Rabbi Shudnow says everyone clean shaven in HTC. Rabbi Shudnow, you don't need the HTC. I could show you Slobodka. I could show you Slobodka 100 years ago in Europe. Everyone clean shaven. You weren't allowed to have a beard. The only people allowed to have a beard were the Rosh Yeshiva. And of course, you weren't allowed to wear a black jacket either. You had to wear a light jacket. Bill Gewertz, Alan Senior, graduated from YU in 69. And Rabbi Shudnow mentions Rabbi Herschel Schechter and his relationship with him. Yes, he was very involved in, he was a chaplain, of course, and he was involved in many, many Jewish organizations. Then when he had like he had a few careers, but when he retired from being very active with Soviet Jewry and conference of major presidents, then he's does the placement office at YU. But that was after he already achieved very important things in his other career. He also, I learned very unusually, he broke with a lot of other Orthodox rabbis much. He supported Nixon. He was a Republican, which is quite unusual. Remember, today it's not unusual. Today, finding a Democrat, well, Democrat and Orthodox show under 60, it's a little tough. But in those days, you couldn't find a Republican. And he was a Republican, him and Rabbi Korff. If anyone remembers Rabbi Korff, he was Nixon's rabbi. So I learned that about Rabbi Schachter. And also, very interesting, talk about his shul. He had this giant shul in the Bronx, which, then eventually there was no one left anymore. So you learn a lot from this book. Howard says that there are years when Rosh Chodesh is on Thanksgiving, and so that you can even pull their legs and say even Hallel. Oh, okay. But I did it as a general rule that they always say Thanksgiving. I did it one time. I should do it again. Susanna says that Spanish and Portuguese still has a Thanksgiving service. Thank you for that. And Rosh Shunno says that Neve Shechter, they observed it with turkey. Yeah. Bogelwart says they davened after Shkia, but not more than 8 to 15 minutes after sunset. Well, the thing is, the Shulchan Aruch speaks about davening, as I recall, until Tzeis. And I'd have to check. You're the expert on Zmanim, but I know that Minhag Rabbi Harfenis, in his book Yisrael Zmanim, has a whole chapter with all the sources that they would daven routinely after Shkia. That was Minhag Yisrael. Baruch says that Lubavitcher say Tachlin on Yort sites. Interesting. And I should know Masoreti is the short Tachlin, not the long version. And someone privately says we have the expert, William Gewertz, so we can discuss davening after Shkia. Yes, well, as I said last class, that Bill Gewertz, who we're fortunate to have here, is an expert in issues of time. In halacha, which most people can't understand. It's a complicated thing. Although I think Bill Gewertz also likes Uktzin, so you should pick up the Sefer I showed you. Mike says that Heschel was saved from Europe by a visa from Hebrew Union College. He taught there, and all the institutions saved people with visas. He was not happy at Hebrew Union College because, especially in those days, today he might have been happier because they're into spirituality. In those days, it was so far removed from traditional Judaism, but that's where he made Parnassa. So he was very happy when he eventually got his appointment at the seminary. More links there, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik and Spanish and Portuguese. The question is there any other synagogue? See, Spanish and Portuguese doesn't change their minhagim. If you go there, they still do things they've been doing for hundreds of years. Are there any other Orthodox shuls that still do anything? I don't know. Rabbi Hartman says, or Kefet records his memoir that where Kefet became from, he didn't want to observe Thanksgiving. He was upset. His mother was upset. And one year, the Rav said that he has to have shir early because he has to return to Boston, where his sister, Mrs. Meisen, will host Thanksgiving dinner. Well, this is famous that Rabbi Soloveitchik in Thanksgiving, it's recorded in Nefesh HaRav. But before it was recorded in Nefesh HaRav, and before Rabbi Rakevitz's memoir, although he said it in Shiurim, I think the very first reference to this was in an article by Rabbi Michael Broyd on Thanksgiving, where he quotes yours truly and Rabbi Jachter, because when we were driving Rabbi Soloveitchik Thanksgiving, I've repeated this a few times, but for the people who haven't heard it, when we were driving from the summer kollel, it was the last year I was in the rough summer kollel, I asked Rabbi Soloveitchik myself, about Thanksgiving. Is there any problem about it? And he was very surprised. He said, what could possibly be the problem? And I said, and now this is what Rav Moshe has conflicting tshuva, but at least in one of the tshuvot, it says that, at least it appears to be conflicting. Roy Greenblatt said it was. At least that's what I recall Rav Greenblatt said. You have to look in the tshuva. Rav Greenblatt didn't have an issue with Thanksgiving, but Rav Moshe, as I recall, says, because if it began for religious reasons, then it's a problem. So this is what Rabbi Soloveitchik said to me. I didn't tell him who said that it's Rav Moshe. I said that some say that because it began for religious reasons, it's problematic for us to celebrate Thanksgiving today. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, and these are his words, I'll never forget it, are you going to church on Thanksgiving? And I said, well, no. And he says, so what's the problem? Those were his words. And that was before I knew that he was a big Thanksgiving person, before I knew that he insisted on having Shia Thanksgiving Day, but it has to be early because he has to go to Boston. I didn't know any of that at that time. I didn't even know what Rav Soloveitchik held. Forget the stories. I just was curious. I was 18 years old, 19 years old then. And I just was curious as to what the Rav would say about that. Susanna says that Professor Faor was the first Jew in 500 years to get a PhD at the University of Barcelona. I would say, Susanna, that he wasn't the first Jew in 500 years. He's the first Jew ever, because there weren't any Jews who ever got a PhD before the expulsion from Spain. Jews got PhDs, medical degrees, I should say, not PhDs, but they got doctor degrees in Padua in Italy. But no Jew ever got a degree. To my knowledge, there never was a Jew who ever got a university degree in Spain. So if, that would make him the first ever. In those days, there were hardly any Jews in Spain also. Rabbi Shunna says, Chacham Faor is close friends with Chaim David Levy. I visited Rabbi Levy in his home in Tel Aviv. Chacham Faor was friend. He also, Rabbi Masas. Rabbi Masas was on the Beis Din in the 1980s that a second time koshered, as it were, Rabbi Faor, but the Syrian community refused to accept it. He was friendly with many of the Sephardic rabbis, the old-fashioned rabbis. Rabbi Hartman says he knew Rabbi Professor Faor, took class with him at Spurs in Chicago. Yes, he also was taught at Spurs for many years. He befriended me because I'm a Talmud of Rav Lifshitz and the Rav, and he wanted, if I could help him become accepted in the Orthodox world. He told me Dr. Tendler was very friendly with him and tried to help him. I was very sad for him. He moved to Israel. Yes, he moved to Israel, and he's taught at Netanya. Look, he's a Syrian, and that's his community. And I guess in theory, we could have brought him in, and he could have taught in the Orthodox world, in the Ashkenazic world. But fundamentally, he's not Aleppo, though. He's from his family's Damascus. And the Syrian communities in America are mostly Aleppo dominated, but it's whatever. It just when the rabbis, the Syrian community, the rabbis are so authoritative, other than Rabbi Shama and a couple others, when the rabbis came out so strong because of the pressure against him, you can't fight it there. The Syrian community, no one wants to be on the outs. So once the ruling came that he can't teach Torah in the Syrian community, that's just the way it is. Rabbi Shinnah says, Rabbi Frankis continued to respect Lieberman and Finkelstein in placing Orthodox Sidurim at the regular seats in the library synagogue. Very nice. Rabbi Yellen says, regarding Rabbi Kelman's chat post about S&P and Thanksgiving, he says that Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik is giving a talk tomorrow at Beth Jacob in LA on one of his favorite topics, the Pilgrims, Rambam, and Washington's Hanukkah, a history of early American Thanksgiving. Very nice, and very nice that if he's in person there, if he's in person, not on Zoom, then that shows we're getting back to life as normal. Rabbi Shunna says he was taught that Rashi was used as a major source for studying medieval French because we know the meaning of the Hebrew. Correct. Rashi is very important for the scholars of medieval French. Rabbi Katan from Shalvim, his father came out with a lexicon translating to Hebrew the words, but it's also many times by us knowing what it means in Old French, it helps us understand as well what he's talking about. Morris says, got a few more left, that Rabbi, I mentioned Rishtanos Gemara, which contains realia. He also wrote a modest commentary on Tosefta, explaining terms in the back in the Hebrew edition. You wonder if there's similarities between these two geniuses. I have to tell you, I never saw Rabbi Steinsaltz's in Steinsaltz Gemara is in the back. He has a Tosefta. Yeah. I don't know if he uses that. It's not really such an extensive commentary. Bill Gewirtz says that the Brit that Lieberman met the Rav at was Professor Hyman's son. Professor Hyman told me that Rav Chaim Heller, the Rav, and the Grosh sat and were talking for hours after the Brit. So here I'll tell you something. It's not a secret, but Professor Hyman went to the seminary. He's a musmach of the seminary. His Masara Kiddushin was Finkelstein. I know that because I was in his house. I live near him on the Upper West Side. I went to him for Shabbos. He called me up once, like the night before New Year's, and asked me to come over to his house to bring in the New Year. He was such a wonderful man. This was after his wife died. But he told me, how did he get the job at YU? Professor Arthur Hyman, I mean, Big Black Yarmulke, Tom Chacham, Shomer Torah Mitzvos, expert in philosophy, he told me that the Rav called Wolfson. In those days, it's not like today where you have to apply for jobs and there's affirmative action, everyone has to do things by the books. The Rav called Wolfson and said, you know, we need a professor of philosophy, or no, Belkin called Wolfson. We need a professor of philosophy. So Belkin gave him Hyman. Hyman told me, by the way, that in Wolfson's apartment, they had so many books, he put books in the oven. And because he would go out to a local cafe. He wasn't kosher Wolfson, so he ate there. But he said that there are actual books in the oven. So Hyman's a Talmud of Wolfson. But Hyman told me that today there is no way in the world, coming, you know, from the seminary, he could ever be hired at YU. Professor Faor said he was a Talmud Chavar of Varon. I don't know what it means Chavar, but he was definitely a Talmud. Baruch says the strong language in Talmudic debate harkens back to the Gemara. It's not a Lithuanian invention. No, but I'm not referring to strong language. I'm referring to knocking people. It's a Lithuanian trait to knock Talmidei Chachamim if you think they're Amoratzim. If you've ever been in a Lithuanian yeshiva world, you know that that's the hak. And you hear it from Talmidei Chachamim and Rashi Yeshiva too, that it's like they don't consider this a personal criticism. This is like saying about a baseball player, he can't hit. You're not saying anything bad about him. It's just that he can't hit. So that's how I understand it, because I've heard from Gedolei Yisrael, one in particular, put downs of other Gedolei Yisrael. And what am I going to say? It's Lashon Hara? No, it's you're saying he doesn't know how to learn. That's, you know, if you come into the ring, if you can't box, if you can't learn, then we're going to point it out. Ah, so Mike points out he doesn't, in the famous expression, it's like he doesn't have a brain in his head. Yeah. Okay, so having the Gemara as well. But it's shocking. I'm telling you, if you have never been in that world, to hear the way they refer to others and their lack of knowledge. And we're talking about great Torah scholars saying about others. Bill says, in my day, the Rav said to a young man, you must be a genius. You came straight from the 8th grade. You cannot read. I think this is the 3rd year in 69, not that mellow. But everyone knows that he became mellower. And yes, and someone privately says, many chassim don't say tachlim even when dav minchay for shkia, because it's always a yortzeit. They can always find a yortzeit. No, I don't need translation of the German sources. I just sent to one of the journals, and hopefully it'll appear. They have to look at it. Rav Israel Hildesheimer has an essay on teaching women Torah. Never before appeared in English. I worked long and hard on it, on the German translation. Then I got someone, an expert German translator, to read it over. So hopefully it'll appear. So we'll see. Rav Israel Hildesheimer, really the first one to teach women Torah in an organized fashion, him and Hirsch. And finally, the last thing, someone privately texts me. The problem with Thanksgiving is the failure to recognize the negative impact the arrival of the pilgrims had on the indigenous population. That gets us into modern politics, and I will leave that aside. And look, at the end of the day, everywhere, every new arrival has meant trouble for the people they overtake. And my university made an announcement 2 weeks ago. At all official events, they will say that the University of Scranton, on land that formerly belonged to whatever, I forgot the name of the Indians, what they are. But you know something? Does that mean that now all of a sudden, every time they mention Hebron and Nablus, we'll say on land that formerly belonged to the Jewish people? Because that used to be our land too. So it doesn't, I'm all for it, but then let's remember it has to go in all ways. East Jerusalem, that, hey, Jews even lived in Gaza. You heard of Nathan of Gaza? Remember him? So I'm all for it, but we have to remember that it has to go in every direction as well. So with that, I will end. Thank you all. Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you. I'll just say, you know, the famous story of Rabbi Yisroel Salanter comes to the base measures of Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, of course. Yeah. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer is giving a shiur to men and women, sitting together, giving a shiur in the 1800s. And Rabbi Yisroel Salanter says if he tried this in Eastern Europe, they would throw him out, they'd put him into cherem. But Yehei Chelki, I wish that my share in Olam Hava will be with us, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer.
And that is recorded for posterity in the Sri Deish. And you just left out one point, though. Rabbi Yisroel Salanter said if he tried in Eastern Europe, exactly what you said, they'd throw him out. And Rabbi Yisroel Salanter said, but they'd be right. And they'd be right.
Oh, I'm definitely right. Eastern okay, Europe, I forgot that part.
It's right. Not the,
the context, right? The everything. Context.
They're not ready right. for that yet.
So that's the same thing on women rabbis, you know? That's the okay, same issue
so we will get to women rabbis. The great irony is that Orthodox, or some of you might put Orthodox in quotes, are having women rabbis, and it was Lieberman and the traditional conservatives who refused it. But we have to analyze the women's rabbi issue.
I will tell you, when they started the partnership minion in Toronto, I don't want to, whatever, you can probably figure it out. When they started the partnership minion in Toronto, the rabbi who was sort of their guide told me he got one phone call from a conservative rabbi complaining. He said, yes, and I'm my conservative shul. I'm trying to hold the old traditions. You know, the woman can't have all these rights. And you're running an Orthodox shul where, you know, mechitza and everything, and the woman can get aliyah. Like, you're undermining what I'm doing in the conservative movement.
Same thing happened in Hillcrest when they had the women's prayer service, Rabbi Krauss said. So, but we have to look at it because let's not forget, Devorah, as we'll see, you know, Tosfos already says, explains why she could have her role. So we're not going to get into the politics so much, but the halachic sources we'll look at. Right. Hopefully next class.
Okay, very good. Okay, thank you very much. Look forward to next week. Tomorrow, of course, doubleheader, Rachel Danziger. Rachel Sharansky Danziger continuing her series after last week's break on Genesis relationships and Brennan's in Genesis. And then Rabbi Aaron Adler continuing part two on Hanukkah, or the Rav Soloveitchik on Hanukkah. That's tomorrow at 1. So 11 and 1 tomorrow. Then Wednesday night and Thursday, 2 shiurim, and Friday morning. So we look forward to learning with you. Invite a friend. And of course, just to make mention, we haven't mentioned, of course, please God, we'll be going to Morocco in the beginning of January. That's our first trip, obviously, in a couple of years. And there's still a few places left if anybody's interested. And hopefully, please God, we go to Portugal and places in the summer. But and then we can have Dr. Shakira talk on the bus, a walking library, and, you know, in a nice, intimate environment. And really, it's a wonderful trip, the Morocco trip. This will be, please God, our third trip going to Morocco. And so that's January 3rd. If things are getting back to normal, please God, hopefully. Obviously, the trip's only open to vaccinated people and whatever. But
and Morocco has like no COVID. So they have like 80 cases, 39 million people, like 80, 90 cases a day. It's as low as anywhere in the world. So it's a great place to be at present.
Okay, whatever. Let's hope everywhere should, you know, move on. But okay, what can we do? Listen, we have to learn to live with it a little. I've been pretty like machmir on, you know, going places. But whatever we do, people do. We can. Let's hope for good news. Okay, everybody, Laila Tov, and invite your friends, and we look forward to learning with you. Okay,
Rabbah.
Thank you very much. Be well. Thank you.